From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, Christopher Curtis's second novel, Bud Not Buddy, became the first book to win the Newbery Medal for Children's Literature and the Coretta Scott King Award. Curtis's first novel, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963, won honors in both awards. Curtis worked on an automobile assembly line for 13 years before writing his first book. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk about his life and writing. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new suspense novels set in our nation's capital, and music critic Milo Miles reviews the new Stevie Wonder box set At the Close of a Century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Presidential candidates from both parties will face off in separate debates tonight in New Hampshire. The Republicans just began their 90-minute debate to be followed on the same stage 30 minutes later by the Democrats. The GOP contenders are expected to argue over tax cuts and abortion rights. Although Vice President Al Gore finished well ahead of former Senator Bill Bradley in the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire polls show the two are neck and neck just 6 days before the primary. The Republican presidential field is down to five following today's withdrawal by Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Hatch endorsed Texas Governor George W. Bush, saying he's the only Republican who can take back the White House. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
His campaign is short on time, money, and support. And the Senate Judiciary Chairman says he's ready to concede that voters just weren't moved by his message of experience in government. In fact, Hatch was a little frustrated to find how few people outside Washington even know who he is.
I knew I was having problems when a lady in New Hampshire came up to me and she asked if she could have her picture taken with me. And I said, really, do you want to send this picture to your kids? She said, no. She said, I just need to finish out the roll.
Despite having joked that Governor Bush would benefit from being his vice president for 8 years, Hatch now says Bush is the candidate most likely to advance the Republican agenda while reaching across party lines. Campaigning in New Hampshire, Bush said he was grateful for the endorsement. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Elian Gonzalez has been meeting with his two Cuban grandmothers at a neutral site in Miami Beach. The grandmothers were to see Elian privately with the boy's Miami relatives waiting in a nearby room. Elian's father asked to speak to the boy by telephone from Cuba, but it's not known whether that wish was granted. Medicaid recipients are suing to get a share of the $206 billion settlement between tobacco companies and the states, NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Lawyers in eight states are filing class action lawsuits today that claim states are violating federal Medicaid law by keeping all their settlement proceeds. Similar lawsuits have already been filed in at least five other states. The plaintiffs contend that once states recover the cost of treating sick smokers on Medicaid, any additional settlement funds should be distributed to Medicaid recipients. Suing the states won't be easy, according to Richard Daynard with the Tobacco Products Liability Project.
I think the plaintiffs in these cases have a very uphill fight.
Daynard says the 11th Amendment generally protects states from federal lawsuits, and he says it will be difficult to determine how much of the settlement was intended to cover Medicaid spending since the tobacco lawsuits included other claims. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 3 points to close at 11,033. This is NPR News. State troopers in Wyoming say two children were killed and three other people injured early today when a snowplow crashed into a school bus on an icy rural road. The crash took place about 8 o'clock this morning near the ranching town of Albin. NASA scientists are cautiously optimistic that they may have detected a faint signal from the Mars Polar Lander spacecraft. The lander hasn't been heard from since it began its descent to the Martian surface on December 3rd. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
An antenna at Stanford has picked out what appear to be very faint signals from Mars. The transmissions were received on December 18th and January 4th, but only identified after extensive data analysis. Flight operations manager Sam Thurman says he was blown away when he heard the news, but Thurman is also urging caution. It's possible the signals are really coming from a TV station or something on Earth, though the signals are at the right frequency and have the right shape for a lander transmission. Over the past few days, NASA scientists have sent signals to Mars telling the lander to broadcast again. Thurman compared trying to pick out such a weak transmission to trying to see someone on Mars holding up a flashlight. Thurman says there is no chance of salvaging the mission, but a signal in the coming days would at least tell them the craft was alive. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress today that the economy is in the midst of a technological revolution that's boosting productivity and raising American living standards. Greenspan appeared before the Senate Banking Committee, which is considering his nomination to a fourth term as head of the central bank. Greenspan said the Fed will continue to try to keep interest rates low and stable while allowing the economy to grow. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, Christopher Curtis's novel, Bud Not Buddy, won the Newbery Medal for the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children and the Coretta Scott King Award. It's the first book to win both awards, which are given by the American Library Association. Curtis's first novel, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963, won honors from both awards. Last week's news was great for the sales of Bud Not Buddy. For a brief time, it was higher than the Harry Potter books on the Amazon.com bestseller list. The awards were particularly gratifying because Curtis worked on an automobile assembly line in Flint, Michigan for 13 years before writing a novel, and he wasn't confident he'd ever be published. I asked him how he heard the good news about the awards.
It was overwhelming, really. I got the call from the Coretta Scott King people first, and it was a very short call, and it kind of took me by surprise. And then about 20 minutes later, the Newbery panel called and told me. And I'd had a rough night the night before because there'd been a lot of talk beforehand that the book had a good chance of winning. And it was just a terrible night. I woke up at 3 o'clock and made my daughter's lunch. And my office is cleaner than it's ever been before. I just found a million things to do.
Let's talk about the new book that just won these awards. It's called Bud, Not Buddy. Give us a little capsule of the story.
Bud, Not Buddy is the story of a 10-year-old orphan from Flint during the Depression, and he thinks that there's a possibility that there's a man on the other side of the state who's his father. And it tells about Bud's journey from a series of bad foster homes and orphanages to finally walk across the state and try to find this man and see if it is his father.
Why did you set this story during the Depression?
Originally, I was writing a story about the factory that I'd worked in Flint. Right out of high school, I started working at the Fisher Body Flint No. 1 factory, and it was a very historical plant. I was also going to the University of Michigan at the time, and I had a labor professor there, Neil Layton, who brought the sit-down strike to life for me. He told about the time in the 1930s when the workers took over the factory, Fisher 1, the plant that I eventually worked at, and he told how tanks had ring the plant, and it was a very dramatic time, and I'd never read anything about it, and I thought it was something that was important for children to know about, so I started writing a story that revolved around the sit-down strike. But in the meantime, I went to a family reunion in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and people started talking about my grandfather. Herman E. Curtis was his name, and he was a big band leader back in the 30s and had a band called Herman E. Curtis and the Dusky Devastators of the Depression.
What a great name.
Isn't that a name? When I heard that, I started taking notes about Grandpa. And when I write, I like to have two things going at the same time so I'll get tired of writing one thing and I can switch over to the other and won't stop writing. So this story about the band leader kind of took over and I never finished the sit-down strike story.
In the afterword of your book, you explain to your readers that when your parents and grandparents used to tell you stories about their lives during the Depression, you would just get really bored. And you urge your readers to ask their relatives about their lives and not make the same mistake you made.
Right, right.
I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from Bud Not Buddy. And this is the part where he has these posters from the man who he assumes is his father, who, you know, led this this jazz band. And, you know, he's desperate to find his father, and all he has to go by are these posters, which he keeps in the bottom of his valise. And in this section, he pulls out the posters and looks at them and wonders about the man who he believes is his father.
Across the top of the flyer, writ in big black letters, were the words, "Limited Engagement." Then in little letters it said, "Direct from an SRO engagement in New York City." Underneath that, in big letters again, it said, "Herman E. Calloway and the Dusky Devastators of the Depression," followed by 6 exclamation points. Those 6 exclamation points made it seem like this was the most important news anyone could think of. Seems like you'd have to be really great to deserve all of those exclamation points all stacked up in a row like that. Next, the paper said, "Masters of the New Jazz." Then in the middle of the flyer was a blurry picture of the man I have a real good suspicion about. I've never met him, but I have a pretty good feeling that this guy must be my father.
That's Christopher Curtis reading an excerpt of Bud, Not Buddy. Did your grandfather, who had a band called the Dusky Devastators of the Depression, have flyers similar to the one that Bud sees?
I'm sure he did. Grandpa Curtis was a real salesman. He even took sales to the extent that he was threatened with a lawsuit by NBC, because back in the 30s he had a radio station, or he had airtime at a radio station in Grand Rapids where he'd play his music. And he always started the show by doing the little gong, the bong, bing, boo, that NBC used, and said, "This is the NBC network, nobody but Curtis." So NBC sent a letter saying that he had to stop doing that. So I imagine... I imagine he had lots of little ways. I'd never seen any of the actual posters that he put up, but it's not a far stretch to imagine that that happened.
Well, I think the most important question is, did his band's name have 6 exclamation points in it, like the band in your book?
No, that's something the grandson put in. The name just impressed me so much that I thought it deserved 6 exclamation points.
Tell us what you know about your grandfather's band.
He was, like I said, he was a real promoter. He worked very hard, and he knew that he couldn't make money just being a jazz band. So his band would do millions of different things. They would play polka, they would play country and western, they'd play anything that you wanted to hear. And each band had a different name, but it was always the same people. And one of the other aspects of his band, he usually had a white player in the band to deal with cases where they'd go places, and there were still lots of segregation back then, and the white person would be kind of a front to get them access to things. And also the white musician, there were laws in Wyoming, Michigan, and I believe in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that black people couldn't own property at the time in certain areas. And he'd get around that by having this white band leader have the property in his name while it actually belonged to him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Curtis, and his new book, Bud, Not Buddy, just won both the Coretta Scott King Award and the Newbery Medal for young people's fiction. Now, your other grandfather inspired another character in Bud, Not Buddy. Tell us about the character he inspired.
The character that my mother's father inspired is Lefty Lewis. I didn't even disguise the name. I used his real name, Earl Lefty Lewis. And he was spent much of his time as a red cap at the Grand Rapids train station. And the red caps were the people who would take bags from cars to the train and vice versa, where the Pullman porters would take over. But Grandpa was also a pitcher in the Negro baseball leagues. And his claim to fame was that he pitched twice against Satchel Paige and lost both times.
I bet there are a lot of stories about that in the family.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories. And Grandpa used to love to tell the stories. But like I say in the afterword, I was at an age when I really didn't want to hear those stories. They were boring. You hear them one time. They were funny the first time you heard them. But when Grandpa would go back over them again and again, they were something that you just didn't want to hear. And I really regret the fact that I didn't, because not only in the sense that there's a lot of personal history that's lost, but it'd make it a lot easier, my life as a writer, because there are a lot of stories that would have a real natural and true ring to them that Grandpa would tell, and now I have to make up details that otherwise I would have known.
How close were you to your grandparents?
My father's father died when I was about 10, so I really don't have a lot of memories of him. But I was very close to Grandpa Lewis. He lived into his 80s. And I used to spend every summer in Grand Rapids at my cousin's house. And Grandpa lived right across the street. And he was also a cab driver, so he'd come home and he'd have pockets full of tips. And he used to give us nickels and quarters. Whenever we'd see the cab come up the street, we'd run to the cab because we knew Grandpa would always give us some money.
Now, in your novel, Bud cherishes the memory of how his mother used to read him to sleep. Did your mother read you to sleep?
Actually, the reader in my family, to me, was my older sister, Lindsay. My parents made a real financial sacrifice when I was about 5 or 6 years old. We came home from school one day, and my father lined us up in front of this brand-new bookcase, and here were these gorgeous world books and childcraft books. And Dad said, these books cost $300. I don't want to see a pencil or a crayon anywhere near any of them. And my sister Lindsay would take the childcraft book and the world book, and we'd sit in the hall, and she'd go through and read things to me. And to this very day, my favorite section of the world book was the dog section. I know dogs. I know every breed of dog in the world. I can look at a dog and say, that's a mix between a Newfoundland and a Bichon Frise. And I know dogs from that. It's amazing how that kind of gets imprinted on you.
There's a description in Bud Not Buddy of all the smells in the library, the smell of the paper, the smell of the cover of a book. Did you go to the library a lot, and do you have vivid sensual sense memories of it?
Yeah, the library was kind of a refuge for me. Every Saturday, I'd go to the library, and I liked the atmosphere there, and it was kind of, the air always seemed cooler in the library, and people were very friendly, and I could sit and I could look through books, and like much like Bud did, I'd look through books of the Civil War with pictures of the Civil War because they had the most gruesome corpses you'd ever seen, and this was something that really fascinated a 10-year-old boy. So I'd go to the library for that, and even to this day, both of the books, The Watsons Go to Birmingham and Bud Not Buddy, were written in the library.
Oh, really? Why? Do you like to write in the library?
It seems to be the only place that I can write. I go to the public library, and I'd sit in the children's section, and I just start to write. And it's not that it's quiet or that it's peaceful or anything, because there are kids all around. There's story time, and there's someone in the corner reading a story to the kids. And kids come up to me and say, what's this word? And things like that. But it's the energy there, for some reason, is just right for me. So I've kind of talked myself into believing that the only place I can write is in the library.
So do the kids know what you're up to?
They do now. At first, I was kind of a mystery because when I write, I am almost in a trance state. I forget everything that's around me, and I'll break out laughing, or I'll be searching for a word, and I'll say, blanket, and it'll just come out loud like that, and everybody looks, and nobody knew what I was doing at the time, but since the book has come out, people are aware of what was going on then.
My guest is Christopher Curtis. His new novel, Bud Not Buddy, just won 2 prestigious awards for children's literature. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Curtis, and his new book, Bud Not Buddy, just won the Newbery Gold Medal as well as the Coretta Scott King Award. These are awards for young people's fiction. What did your father do to make a living when you were growing up?
My father always says that I put him in the factory. He was originally a chiropodist, a hand and foot surgeon, and he moved to Flint from Grand Rapids to set up his practice. And it wasn't going really well. And so my birthday is May 10th, 1953. And his seniority date in the factory is May 13th, 1953. So he claims that I was the thing that always pushed him away from being a chiropodist into being in the factory. And he started out on the line and worked there for 13 years. And then when he retired, he was the head of education of Fisher Body.
How long did you spend on the assembly line at Fisher Body?
13 years, the same as my father.
I know you'd started in college. Did you finish, or did you just start to work full-time?
I worked full-time all along, and I'd go to college evenings and some of the time I take what were called educational leaves, where they'd give you time off the factory. And it was a very inefficient way to go to school.
Did you get your degree?
No, I believe I'm one French class away from graduating. And the problem was I took French in 71 when I first started. I had 2 semesters, and you have to have 3 semesters to graduate. And by the time I'd gone back, I'd forgotten every bit of French that I'd ever taken.
Would you describe for us exactly what the job was on the assembly line?
My job was to hang doors. And if you've ever watched somebody, a worker on the line at a factory, it's really almost a ballet that they're doing. It's like every step is choreographed. The way the line works is one job would come by a minute, and I'd have to take a big fixture that hung from the ceiling and clamp it onto the car and run back over to the side, and there would be doors there. And the doors weighed anywhere from 50 to 80 pounds, so they're very heavy. Pick the door up, bring it over, slide it into the fixture, and I'd have in my hand 6 bolts and a motor, and I'd put 3 in the top, 3 in the bottom, tighten it all the way around, take the fixture off, slide it back, and you're walking backwards all the time this is going on. But the job wasn't over. I'd pull down another fixture, and it would tell if the door was fit properly, and it never was. So I'd have to run over to a table, pick up this big hammer and chisel, put it on the hinge, and bang it until the door got to the right spot. Take that fixture off, throw the hammer and chisel back, and run back and do the second job. I'd do every other job.
And what would you think about as you were doing this repetitive job minute after minute?
About why I didn't listen to my parents and just stay in school. But your mind kind of goes away when you're doing that thing over and over like that. But the solution that my friend and I came up with to try to make it easier was, instead of doing every other job, we decided to double up, which means that he'd do 30 in a row and I'd do 30 in a row. So you're working twice as fast for half the time. And it also gave you 30 minutes off the line, off of every hour. So that's really where I started writing. And I'd sit on the side of the line and I would write. And it made my, that's where I kind of started going into the trance state too. It would make the time go by very quickly. And I'd sit there, and then when I got back up, once I got into this habit of doing it, while I was working, I'd think about what I was going to write.
Did the union support you when you took your writing breaks?
Oh, yeah. There was never really any problem about me taking writing breaks.
Mm-hmm.
I also took saxophone breaks. I had this old alto saxophone, and I'd take it and go into the back and play at the saxophone. I never really learned how to do it.
Who were your idols?
Musically?
Yeah.
John Coltrane. I was a big John Coltrane fan.
And what did you write about when you wrote on breaks? Did you start your novels there, or did you write something else altogether?
Mostly I was writing things like, I hate my foreman's guts, I hate my foreman's guts, over and over. Anything to just, I was actually keeping a journal or a diary of things that were going on. I tried to write fiction, but it just wasn't ready at the time. I tried in my early 20s, and the stories I would write were terrible, and I knew they were terrible, so I thought I'd just wait, because I felt like I wanted to write. But I had sense enough to know what I was doing was really bad, and I felt like time would give me what I needed.
So what changed, and when did you feel that there was a change and that you were ready to write a story that you could feel good about?
Actually, it was a case of my wife had faith in my writing. She had more faith in my writing than I did. She had read the things that I'd written. We had a long-distance relationship, and I used to write a lot of letters to her. And she just thought these letters were the greatest things in the world, and she thought I was a natural writer. And once we'd been married, she agreed to let me take a year off work to try to write a book. So that was really the thing that got me started.
Did she support the family that year?
Yeah, she's a registered nurse, and she supported us. Hers was the only income that we had. And it was kind of a, when you look back at it and you understand the odds of getting a book published and then having it make any kind of money, was a really a naive kind of a leap of faith.
So what did you write that year?
That was the year that I wrote The Watsons Go to Birmingham.
Oh, so you actually wrote a book.
I did. Oh, yeah. I knew I had a year, and I work well under deadlines. I knew that the year was coming to an end. I better finish this book up. Otherwise, I would have wasted a year. So I was able to finish the book.
Did you set out to write a book for young people, or did you think you were going to write, you know, a novel for adults at first?
I thought it was a novel for adults, even though there was a 10-year-old narrating it. I originally wrote it as a book for adults. The reason that it was published as a middle reader was that the only way I could think to get it published was to enter contests. And I entered two different contests. Little Brown had a contest on multicultural children's fiction, and Delacorte had a contest on first young adult contemporary fiction. And I felt like this would be the only way that I'd get a professional editor to read my work, because I knew most places didn't take unsolicited manuscripts. So I sent it off to them, and it was rejected by Little Brown. And fortunately, at Delacorte, the woman who became my editor, Wendy Lamb, read it and liked it and said it couldn't win the contest because it was too young, but they'd publish it anyway.
And then did you start seeing yourself as the author of young people's fiction?
Yeah, well, when I wrote Bud Not Buddy, I tried to put myself in the same frame of mind I was when I wrote The Watsons. So it was a 10-year-old narrator, and I wasn't thinking I'm telling a story for children. I think that's a danger once you get into saying that you're specifically talking to children. I think that the important thing is to tell a good story. So I thought if I told a good story, it would work for children and adults.
Christopher Curtis, his novel Bud Not Buddy, won the Newbery Medal for Children's Literature and the Coretta Scott King Award. Curtis will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Saab, proud sponsor of Jazz at Lincoln Center, and its Essentially Ellington High School Jazz Band Competition and Festival. Information at saabjazz.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Christopher Curtis, who just won two Children's Literature Awards. Maureen Corrigan reviews two new Inside the Beltway thrillers, and Milo Miles reviews the Stevie Wonder box set.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Curtis. Last week, his second novel, Bud Not Buddy, won two awards for children's literature from the American Library Association, the Newbery Medal and the Coretta Scott King Award. It was the first book to win both. He worked at an automobile assembly line in Flint, Michigan for 13 years before writing his first novel. Let's talk about that first novel that you wrote when you took your year off from the assembly line. It's called The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. And this book won a Newbery Runner-Up Award, a Newbery Honor,
right,
and also won an honor from the Coretta Scott King Awards. This is about a young boy whose older brother, his 13-year-old brother, is becoming a juvenile delinquent. So their parents decide to send the older brother to Alabama to be with the grandparents with the hope that he'll straighten out.
Right.
Is this a memory you have from your childhood of being kids, of having kids sent to the South to straighten out?
Flint is an unusual city because a lot of the people from Flint are directly from the South. And a lot of my friends would disappear in the summer because their parents would be fed up with them and would send them South to these impossibly strict grandparents. And it's supposed to be the ultimate torture for a kid, is to be sent down home to have grandma so-and-so straighten you out. So these were from stories that I've heard all along as I was growing up.
But you didn't experience it in your family?
No. Nobody in my family lived in the South. They were from Grand Rapids in Indiana.
Of course, with the trip to the South also comes exposure to the Civil Rights Movement.
Right. I hope that the book doesn't come across as a book about the civil rights, though. Much like I hope that Bud Not Buddy doesn't come across as a book about the Depression. It's really a book, both are books about two 10-year-old little boys and their lives. And what I hope happens is that kids get caught up in the lives first, and then in the Watsons, it's towards the end of the book that they go South. And I hope that by being caught up with the Watsons' lives, they can have some kind of empathy or some kind of feeling for children who were actually exposed to the things that happened in Birmingham and throughout the South at the time.
I'm wondering if there are a lot of young people in your life, and that when your book started connecting to young readers, if you felt connected to those readers. You know, like some adults really connect and understand kids, and some adults really don't.
I think I really do understand them, but I think it comes more from not aging that way myself so much. I feel like a kid in a lot of ways. And my son, when I wrote The Watsons, was 14 and 15 years old, and I'd give it to him to read, and he was a great help as far as giving me feedback about the book and telling me, this doesn't sound right, that doesn't sound right. But I think that a lot of it comes from inside me. I feel like a kid in a lot of ways.
What kind of advice did your son give you?
He'd tell me things that the language didn't sound right. One of the problems in the book, there's a character called the Woolpoo. And that comes across. Grandma Sands has this southern accent, and she tells the boys to stay away from the water because they'll get caught up in the whirlpool. And Byron, the older brother, tells Kenny that Grandma Sands said that they'd be caught by the Woolpoo, which is Winnie the Pooh's evil twin brother that nobody writes about. So originally I had that as the undertoad and the undertow. And it got through a lot of the editors, and near the end someone said, oh, my God, you can't use that. That is in The World According to Garp by John Irving. And we were at a real tough point there because we had to have something that would, the pronunciation would be corrupted and would make sense in the book. And Stephen was the one who came up with Woolpool and Whirlpool. So he was just very helpful, a lot of things. It's hard when you've written something to give it to somebody to get criticism that can help you. And for some reason, my son was very helpful with that.
Authors are often expected to promote their books, which means, you know, going on interview programs, doing book signings in bookstores. When your audience is preteens, how do you promote the book?
The book is largely promoted to teachers. Most of the things that I go to are functions for teachers. When I go to bookstores, they'll have teachers' night, and they bring the teachers in, and we talk to them like that. I do a lot of appearances at schools where I talk to the kids, but most of the promotion things are to teachers. So I do deal with adults.
I'm wondering if the young people's book market is a fairly segregated or integrated market. Is it assumed that, like, white kids read books about white characters and African-American kids read books about African-American characters?
I think the assumption has been for a long time that white kids read about white characters and black kids read about white characters, because there really haven't been a lot of books for, by, or about African-Americans. I think that's one of the reasons my books have been successful, is that there's kind of a vacuum out there. There's really only one other writer, African-American male writer, who writes for this age group. That's Walter Dean Myers, who just won the Prince Award for his book Monster. But most of the books are not written for African-American children. There are not a lot of African-American protagonists in books. And one of the things that happened, a lot of times when I go to schools, I'm asked questions by kids, and it's kind of, you get the same questions over and over, and you get fall into this pattern of just having rote answers, really. The question triggers a specific answer. And I'd gone to one school, and a little girl asked me, what book really touched you when you were a kid growing up? And I could see that she was one of these kids who really reads, and books really kind of burn in them. Every once in a while, you'll see a child like that. And I didn't have an answer for her. And I think that the reason was that there weren't any books that were really by, for, or about me. I read lots of books, and I was a very good reader, but none of the books seemed to really touch me. I can't think of a book as a child that I could say, I really love that book.
Well, you read a lot in spite of the fact that there weren't books with African-American characters in it that you could find. So what did you read?
I was a big fan of Mad Magazine. I'd read comic books. I'd read Popular Mechanics. I'd read sports magazines. I'd read the World Book, of course. I read newspapers, just about anything. I was a voracious reader, but as far as being the kind of child who would sit down and read a novel and get enjoyment out of it, I wasn't that kind of child. It took me a long time later.
When were you introduced to adult African-American writers, and when did those books start to become of interest to you?
I was introduced to them really all along. My parents would read adult African-American literature, so it was always there, but it wasn't actually until I was in the factory, and the times that I wasn't writing, I'd want something to read. I'd go to my parents' house, I'd borrow a book, and a lot of times they were African-American writers. I really, and like I said about the binge reading, I'd go off on binges. I'd read everything that Langston Hughes had written, Zora Neale Hurston. I'd read the things that she'd written. Toni Morrison had really published much at that time. But I'd find particular writers, Claude McKay, and I'd get stuck on them. John A. Williams was a favorite of mine.
My guest is Christopher Curtis. His new novel, Bud Not Buddy, just won two prestigious awards for children's literature. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Curtis. His novel, Bud Not Buddy, is the first book to win the Newbery Medal for Children's Literature and the Coretta Scott King Award. Your daughter, I believe, made a contribution to your new book. There's a song in there that one of the kids sings called Mommy Says No.
That's
and
right.
I understand this lyric is by your daughter, who is how old?
She's 8. When she was 5, she came to me and said, Daddy, I wrote a song. Do you want to hear it? And I've heard her songs before, and I didn't want to hear it for real. But I said, sure, Sydney, let me hear it. And she goes through this procedure every time when she's going to sing. She really enjoys writing songs. And she stands very straight, and she clears her throat, and she announces the name of the song. And she said, this song is called Mommy Says No. And Mommy Says No, the way Mommy Says No goes is, Mommy says no, Mommy says no, I listen, you don't wah-ha-ha-ha. And then she repeated that again and again and again. And I stopped her and said, Sydney, that's very nice, but you have to have more than one chorus to a song, more than one verse. And she thought for 1 second and said, okay. And then she said, mommy says no, mommy says no. I listen, you don't, wah-ha-ha-ha. The building falls down, the building falls down. You get crushed, I don't, wah-ha-ha-ha. And I said to myself, the stuff of great literature. And I knew that had to go in my book. And it was great because when we got the first copy of the book on the copyright page, it had published by Random House and then copyright 1999 Christopher Paul Curtis. And under that it said lyrics from Mommy Says No, copyright 1999 Sidney McKenzie Curtis, used by permission of the author.
You should have told your daughter she needed a bridge for the song, too.
It needed so much, I didn't know where to start to tell her.
Well, when the main character in the story hears the song, his reaction is, that was about the worst song I've ever heard.
And when I read the book to Sidney, I kind of censored that part. He said, what a nice song.
Well, someday she'll be old enough to read it for herself.
Yeah, well, she's at that point now, and I'm going to have to prepare her about how you take literary license with things.
Now, you have two children?
Yes, I do. Son, Stephen, who's 21 and in the U.S. Navy, and a daughter, Sydney, who's 8 now.
So they're pretty far apart in age.
Very far apart, and it's kind of strange because they've been raised really in two different ways. They have a different idea of what work is, I think. Stephen used to see me come home from work, and I'd be dirty, and I'd be tired, and I'd be unpleasant. And he kind of has this concept that that's what work is about. Sydney, on the other hand, has never seen me do that. I was listening to her talking to some of her friends, and one of her friends asked her, what does your daddy do for a living? And she said, nothing. So I had to let her know, no, Sydney, I work very hard at the library. You just don't see me.
Did you read to both of your children, and did the books you read to them change?
My wife is the reader. Into both of the kids. For some reason, neither one of them wanted me to read to them. Sydney does not want me to read to her. And I think I'm a much better reader than my wife. I put a lot of inflection in. I give the characters voices. And Kay has this kind of this flat, monotonous tone that they seem to really like.
Are you working on a new book?
Yeah, I'm working on a book now called Bucking the Sarge. And it's a story of a 15-year-old boy from Flint, again. It's contemporary, whose mother owns a lot of group homes and rental properties. And she is a scam artist, really. And she wants him to take over the scam business. And he's not interested in doing that.
And that's for adults or for young people?
This is for young adults. This is the age group from 14 and up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different age group than the Watsons and Bud Not Buddy.
Do you have any teachers who are following the success you're having now and getting in touch with you, or you're getting in touch with them?
Teachers of mine?
Yeah, teachers from your school days.
Right. One of the most emotional things that happened to me about this whole writing business is after the Watsons Go to Birmingham came out, the Flint Public Library had a Christopher Curtis Day. And a bunch of people came, and I was supposed to do a reading. And they said right before I got up to do my reading, they said, as a special surprise, we'll have somebody introduce Mr. Curtis. And this very petite woman stood up, and she walked forward, and there was something familiar about her. And then she said, Christopher Curtis is Room C's Good Citizen of the Day. And I just about passed out. It was my third grade teacher, Miss Henry. And she was always my favorite teacher. I put her name in the book. And when I was listening to her introduce me, I was wondering why I felt so strongly for her, and I really couldn't figure it out. I'd been with her only for 9 months, but I think teachers have a real impact some of the time that's positive. And I really enjoyed being introduced by Miss Henry. She even gave me a blue star for my forehead.
Oh, when you did your reading?
Yes.
Well, Christopher Curtis, congratulations, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christopher Curtis's novel, Bud Not Buddy, just won two prestigious awards for children's literature. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a couple of recommendations for adults, two new suspense novels.
From that ultimate Cold War white-knuckle novel, Failsafe, to the current primetime TV political soap, The West Wing, the genre of the Washington thriller has defined itself through certain stock images. a rainy nighttime scene in which the Capitol is shrouded in mist, an anxious pajama-clad president talking on the red phone, and finally, often a subplot involving the president's daughter, wife, or mistress, whose life is sacrificed in exchange for the continued well-being of the galaxy, or at least New York City. But those of us who live in Washington, D.C., know that another city coexists alongside the cosmopolitan capital. Our familiar Washington is a tumble-down town whose history of corruption, underfunded municipal services, stark racial divides, and greasy palms provides the material out of which great, though smaller-scale, suspense stories are made. Two sharp-eyed thriller writers have spotted their hometown city's seedy literary potential. Shame the Devil by George Pelicanos and Chaos Theory by Gary Crist take place on the streets of a Washington, D.C. that only its residents know and fear. You might call them way inside the Beltway thrillers. For a D.C. resident, reading George Pelicanos is a little like listening to the local news. He captures not only the city's characteristic mishaps, but also its tone. The hollow feeling of the suburbs and slums of a city where no one is really in charge. Shame the Devil is Pelicanos' eighth novel set in Washington, and it's a winner, fast-paced and packed with vividly drawn criminals and potential victims. The crime that sets the story in motion is bungled, appropriately enough for a city where lots of things don't work. In the summer of 1995, a vicious ex-con named Frank Farrow and his partner, Roman Otis, hold up a restaurant in well-heeled Northwest Washington. But when the owner pulls a gun on the crooks, they shoot him dead and then execute all the employees. Meanwhile, outside the restaurant, a D.C. cop spots the getaway car and in the gun battle that ensues, kills the driver, who's Farrow's dumb younger brother. Farrow and Otis escape, but Farrow vows revenge. Fast forward to 1998. Since the murders occurred, relatives of the slain employees have been meeting weekly in an informal support group. When Farrow decides it's time to emerge from hibernation to avenge his brother's death, the safety of the group is jeopardized. Sure, the plot of Shame the Devil is contrived, but you hardly notice because Pelicanos is such a terrific writer. His main characters, particularly his anti-hero, a small-time private eye named Nick Stefanos, are so compelling and pockmarked by moral failings that you don't just feel like you know them, you feel like you were them in some other life. Minor figures are rendered memorable in a few assured strokes. For instance, describing a police detective who's killing an afternoon at a bar, Pelicanos writes, "There were certain kinds of drinkers who had a sleepy kind of cruelty in their eyes." As for suspense, well, reading Shame the Devil is a great yoga exercise. You inhale on page one and don't fully exhale until the penultimate chapter. In between, there are murders, double crosses, and one of the most restrained yet sadistic sex scenes I've ever read, involving nothing kinky, just a very loose thumbnail. Chaos Theory is also a winner, a bit less hard-boiled perhaps, but no less grim in its estimation of Washington. Like Shame the Devil, it's situated primarily in Northwest D.C., the city's most affluent and whitest quadrant, as if to imply that the lawyers and other symbol analysts who live there shouldn't feel too smug about their burglar alarms. When the novel opens, two Northwest high school students, Dennis Monroe, who's black, and his friend Jason Rourke, who's white, give in to a daredevil impulse and take a drive at night into the city's netherworld to buy a few joints. But they choose the wrong street dealer. He pulls a pistol on them, and the boys take off in their car, slamming the dealer into a parked car and, they assume, killing him. Matters get worse when the next day they learn that the dealer was an undercover cop. Except, and here's the curious thing, the dead cop's picture in the newspaper doesn't match up with the boys' memories of the dead dealer's face. Aided by their sexy and hard-nosed high school journalism teacher, Dennis and Jason gradually realize they've stumbled into the thick of an evil identity swapping scheme run by some of DC's own municipal agencies. Chaos theory stirs up real terror, particularly because we see much of the action through the eyes of teenagers for whom the world feels out of control even on a good day. Chaos is just another word for opportunity, says one of the bad guys, explaining to Dennis why Washington is such a fertile city for corruption. Given that Washington is also still such a segregated city, it's striking that both Pelicanos and Crist populate their superb thrillers with an integrated cast. It's as if in the midst of all this depravity and violence, both novelists also wanted to give their readers a utopian vision of transformed race relations in the nation's capital.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Shame the Devil by George Pelicanos and Chaos Theory by Gary Crist. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews the new Stevie Wonder box set. This is Fresh Air. Stevie Wonder recently released his first box set, a 4-CD collection called At the Close of a Century. He was also a recipient of a 1999 Kennedy Center honor. Music critic Milo Miles has been thinking about Stevie Wonder's place in music history.
Men spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise. Men spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise.
Stevie Wonder belongs to a grand tradition of soul giants who can do it all and who have changed the course of pop music. The tradition started with Ray Charles and runs through Sly Stone, Stevie Wonder, and the artist who should be known as Prince. You could live off their music on a desert island for a long time. Yet Stevie Wonder endures an odd disenfranchisement. He was so overpraised in the middle 1970s, he could have built a pipeline from the Grammy Awards onto his mantelpiece. Since then, he's become taken for granted and often associated with his most pathetic material, such as I Just Called to Say I Love You. So much so that his last three albums have been undervalued, and his first box set, called At the Close of a Century, doesn't feel momentous at all. Too bad, really. Motown president Berry Gordy was drawn to Little Stevie Wonder in 1962 because the preteen seemed to be a pure musical being. And though Wonder has rebelled against the company and gone through unproductive periods, Gordy was right about him. If the careers of Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross, and even the Temptations represent the disturbing dreams of Motown, Stevie Wonder is its fantasy made flesh. Although it won't replace his series of primo albums from the 1970s, At the Close of a Century tells the Stevie Wonder story clearer and with much better sound than ever before. The best of his juvenilia are frisky, exploding, coltish songs. A pair of 1967 singles marked a turn toward the wonder that Berry Gordy wanted. The tunes are I Was Made to Love Her and the much less well-known I'm Wondering.
Well, don't you know I'm wondering? Little girl, I'm wondering. One. And I knew you used to love the very girl he walked upon.
Unlike Michael Jackson, Wonder responded to growing up on stage by turning outward as a diplomat of racial equality as well as social and international justice. However, he just doesn't get it about feminism, and as a pop philosopher, he has served up heaping platefuls of bologna and moonshine over the years. But this is a child who sat on young Muhammad Ali's lap, a man who jammed with an ecstatic Bob Marley, and a crusader who moved Martin Luther King's birthday onto the calendar. He gets to say some silly stuff if he wants. Wonder cannot perform miracles. If he makes synthesizers, intricate funk, and black anger appealing to a mass audience, he cannot also keep those things dangerous. But he can make them righteous and liberating. He's always been bourgeois. He'll never be just a regular guy. He plays insider and outsider better than any of Gordy's other children do. Stevie Wonder is hit singles and big movie deals, Las Vegas and the Kennedy Center, or as one history of Motown put it, urban cool and solid gold.
Milo Miles is music editor for Rock.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Working with Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. And from Sisive, building custom e-business systems for Global 2000 companies worldwide. On the web at CYSIVE.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Surviving the Khmer Rouge, we talk with Luan Ung. She was 5 years old when the Khmer Rouge invaded Phnom Penh, and her family was forced to flee to the countryside. Her parents were killed. She ended up in a camp for child soldiers. She's written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.